Thanks, Adrian. I appreciate that. Ian, you are the coolest guy I know. I want to be like you. What a fantastic poem. Unbelievable. They really are fantastic. Did you hear Adrian say, Stuart keeps things going? I keep things going. Ian comes up and, whoa, well done, Ian. Can I say thank you to Timothy for what he's about to do? Thank you to my daughter as well for helping me, doing these slides, which I hope will come up. You'll notice she's left the room. She was fed up listening to the sermon over and over, but thank you to her. One of the things I would like to do if I ever manage to retire is take my cooking and my baking up to the next level. I thought somebody might laugh. I love watching programs on TV about cooking. My head knowledge is amazing. I watch Saturday Kitchen Live. I love Rick Steen, Nigella, all these kind of people. But above all, I love Mary Berry. Have you got a picture of her, Timothy? I'm a founder member of her fan club. I've never watched The Great British Bake Off again since she was brutally axed. I haven't forgiven anyone for that. Have you ever seen her new series on quick cooking? Have you seen that yet? Linda's nodding. I've even got the book. It's very heavy. Got it for half price, so it's not selling well. But amazing recipes in here. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. And even if you don't like what she teaches, what she does, there are some fabulous photographs of St. Mary in that book. May is well underway now. Summer's upon us, beautiful day today. And I always think we should be putting away thick, hearty soups and comforting apple crumbles and replacing them in this new season. But I'm conscious this might be recorded, and I don't want you to hear me saying it's wrong to have thick, hearty soups and apple crumbles at this time of year, because what matters is what unites us, and we're united in our love of food. I just think that we should be concentrating on cold gazpachos and vichyssoises at this time of year. I don't want you to think that I just looked at those yesterday, but I did. Anyway, here's a very quick recipe for the summer for you. A salad recipe, and I think, again, Timothy's going to help me with this. What you do is you get tiger bread from Morrison's. You can use a cheaper brand like Marks and Spencer's if you like. Butter, you know, there's little curls of butter, very important. And crisps, personally I use Tyrrell's, but you can use a cheaper make like Walker's. And then peanuts and other little things that you might like. You keep the people outside in the sun, people you're going to feed, keep them simmering out there for at least half an hour, because the idea is that they stuff themselves with the bread and other stuff, and then you bring out the main dish. And it's just lettuce. And it's iceberg lettuce, and that's what I use, and it comes from the fridge. Keep it in the fridge. And then you drizzle it with just a few drops of Hellmann's mayonnaise, or you can use Heinz salad cream if you really are pushed. And that's what I call a lettuce salad. And as Mary says, you can have that outside with your family, your friends, on the croquet lawn with Sicilian, homemade Sicilian lemonade. Now, why recipes on this sunny Sunday morning? Well, here's another problem I have. I don't listen very carefully. And when Don asked me to speak, we were in a very noisy place. And I actually thought he said, could you speak on living with lettuce? And turned out it was living letters. So I went down wrong paths all over the place. I was panicking. I was looking at concordances. Looking at all sorts of different versions of the Bible, but finally I found a chapter in the New Testament which mentions lettuce three times. If you have a Bible, look at chapter 12 of Hebrews. And maybe you want to look that up on your smartphone. Hebrews 12, I need to find it myself. The writer says this, therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. So let us throw off, let us run, let us fix our eyes on Jesus. I hope you'll forgive me for those terrible puns. And you will find, to be honest, in chapter 4 of Hebrews, at least two lettuces, and in chapter 10, I think three lettuces, but none which are so close together as Hebrews chapter 12. It says in your bulletin or newsletter, the message of Hebrews. I'm not really going to give you the message of Hebrews, but I maybe will try to do a wee helicopter view of Hebrews very quickly. And if you have a Bible, you might want to look along. If somebody says to you, I know who wrote Hebrews, don't believe him or her. Nobody really knows who wrote this letter. All sorts of guesses. Some of them might be good. Some of them think are way off beam. So we don't really know who wrote it. The scholars think that it was written around about 60 or 70 AD. What we do know is it was written to Hebrew Christians. That is, people who had been Jews but became Christians. How do we know that? Well, if you look through the whole of the letter to the Hebrews, you'll see all sorts of Old Testament references, Judaism all over the place, and even the heroes of the faith mentioned are Old Testament people. But if you wanted the key to what Hebrews is, if you want just a soundbite, look at chapter 1 and verses 1 and 2, where you read this. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. You get the message? It used to be prophets, but now, far more importantly and amazingly, it's God's Son. Timothy, I'm trusting you to do this. I don't trust myself even to look around. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, don't drift away. I think the writer is concerned that people are drifting backwards into Judaism. Chapters 3 and 4, he says, high priest, Jesus is our high priest. Jesus, God's Son. And he says in chapter 4, I think it's at verse 15, we don't have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Chapter 5, verse 12, there's an important verse there. He says to these people who are reading or listening to his letter, he says, you're still on milk, folks. You should be much further down the path. You should be teachers. You should be eating meat, I suppose, he says. Maybe that doesn't appeal to you if you're a vegetarian, but he says, you're still on milk. You're like a baby. You should be way beyond that. Hebrews 8, we don't have enough time really to think about verses 8 to 12, but in there, the writer majors on the new covenant which God has brought through his Son, Jesus. The old covenant, Moses, etc., the new covenant comes from Jesus. And because of him, all of us can know God in our hearts. I will be their God, we read, and they will be my people. Chapter 9, again, I don't really have time to go into all of this, but the blood of Jesus is more effective than the blood of animals. Hundreds and thousands of animals slaughtered in the Old Testament. Their blood couldn't achieve anything. It was temporary. The blood of Jesus cleanses us from all our sins. And we read in Hebrews chapter 10 that his sacrifice was a once-for-all sacrifice. I also want to point out to you in Hebrews chapter 10 at verse 25, a very important verse. The writer says, let us not give up the habit of meeting together as some are doing. And I want to come back to that. Listen out for that as we think together from Hebrews chapter 12 this morning. It's important for us to keep meeting together. Hebrews 11 verse 1, here's a sermon all on its own. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Read that again for yourself later. That's what faith is. Sure of what we hope for, certain of what we do not see. And the rest of chapter 11 of Hebrews is a fantastic list of great men and women of faith from the Old Testament. Amazing people. Read of them and all that they did because of their faith. But at the end of chapter 11, Paul says, I think it's verse 39, but these people never received what they were promised in their own time, but now we have received through Jesus Christ God's promise at the end of his age. Then chapter 12 is, I think, all about discipline. We're coming to look at that in a moment. And chapter 13 is, I suppose, a sweep up. I can't remember what I've said up there, and I'm too scared to look. But it's you know, all sorts of interesting things to say: love, marriage, money, leaders. I'm a wee bit suspicious that maybe somebody else wrote it or somebody else copied it in, but that's what the letter finishes with. It's an amazing letter. I've read it through twice in the last few years. I mean, I'm super spiritual. But I have to be honest with you, I struggled with lots of it. There are bits where I was glazing over, I didn't really understand it. But I encourage you to look at this letter because it's full of nuggets for you and for me as we try to live the Christian life. But let's go back now to Hebrews chapter 12. You remember that great gallery of people of faith that we read about in chapter 11? Having listed so many Old Testament greats, so many wonderful people. I think what we have here, or for me, we have some great sports arena. And I think as Christians, we're pictured as being on the track together. But all around us, the most amazing galleries, almost as wonderful as Tottenham Hotspur's new ground. And in those grandstands, in the crowd, we've got all these fantastic people of faith. I keep leaning on this and it goes down. It's like something out of a Mr. Bean event. We've got all these fantastic people of faith surrounding us, cheering us on, encouraging us, supporting us. I think we've also got, and I think maybe they've got the best seats down at the front nearest the track, I think we've also got family and friends who may have introduced us to Christ and to the Christian faith. And also people dotted around who are unknown to us, but they've been trailblazers of the Christian faith. Maybe they were the people who built this church so that we could learn and worship and grow together. And on the track, I think there are senior runners, people who are pulling us along, pushing us along. And I think you get the picture. We're not alone as Christians running round this track. Then the three lettuces. Number one is in chapter 12 and in verse 1. Excuse me, I'm extremely dry. That's a bad thing to say. Chapter 12 and verse 1. Let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. For me, there's a picture, first of all, of the serious athlete. I think there's a serious athlete coming up. Stripping off for action. Now, any runner, 100 metres, 5,000 metres, any high jumper, long jumper, triple jumper, anything you like to think of, strips down because they don't want to have anything on which hinders them. Imagine if you were watching at the World Championships, the 110-metre hurdles for men, the final, and out come these guys and they take their track suits off and they put them in the blue plastic boxes. You know, the kids who stand behind. I've always wanted to do that. Just stand there behind some famous sprinter and you take their clothes away. But imagine that in one of the sets of starting blocks or whatever you call them, there's a guy in a suit and a tie and heavy brogues and he's got a coat on as well. And you're shouting into the kitchen to someone, I said, come and see this. This is unbelievable. And the other guys who are running in the final are saying to him, hey, mate, or Ian would say that, listen, mate, what are you doing? Take the coat off, you'll never get over these hurdles. That's the kind of picture that we've got here. What hinders you and me from running well the race which is set out before us? It might be an interest, a hobby, a passion. You have to decide for yourself. Maybe it's sport, which I love and others love, which means I don't get to church as much as I should. Maybe it's films and TV, and as a result, I don't read the Bible or pray anything like as much as I should. Maybe I'm not getting, because of my interests and hobbies, etc., to meet with other Christians. Hebrews 10, verse 25, again, that's important. There are many simple pictures. You've got some in your own head. You need to decide what hinders you, as I need to decide what hinders me from following Jesus, as I know I should and as I want to. Having identified it, what are you doing to throw it away? And then the second picture is very much more serious. What is the sin which entangles you? Weighty things might hinder me as I try to run the Christian race, but sin, well, here's an entirely different picture. And again, Timothy, I hope Kirsten's picture is going up there. It's from David Attenborough's Blue Planet, which has taught us so much, hasn't it? Sort of wakened us up. And it's a picture, I hope, maybe you can't see it, but it's a giant turtle completely caught up in a plastic net. Actually, quite an upsetting picture. Did you get upset when you saw half the stuff going on in the sea because of us and our affection for plastic? But you understand that what is hindering me is one thing. What is a sin that entangles me is completely different. It's bad in itself, and it's choking me as this creature is being choked and probably going to starve to death. I'm not able to walk the race, let alone run the race which is set out before me. What is the sin that so easily entangles? Well, it's not defined, is it, if you look at chapter 12? And I think it's not defined because what for me is the sin which so easily entangles me is not going to be the sin which entangles you. But I think we all have some recurring, debilitating sin which keeps coming back again and again and again. Paul had that somewhere in Romans, I've forgotten where. He says, I keep doing what I know I shouldn't do and what I don't want to do, and I keep, I've lost now, I keep doing things that I know I shouldn't do. Oh, woe is me, I think he says. Where is that, Dawn? Romans 15 or something like that? 7, okay. Wee bit out, but have a look for that later. What is your entangling sin? My entangling sin, I think, should really have an S at the end of it, because I think it's sins. I think it would be kidding myself if I said it's only one. And I'd be ashamed, and I think I'd struggle to tell you, even in the remotest, darkest corner of this place, what those entangling sins are. Let me give you one example, and I think it's this, and I'm not proud of this. In fact, it's the opposite. Selfishness. I think I'm more and more acutely aware, the older I get, that selfishness is some kind of disease within me. I might hide it pretty well, I hope I do, but it's there. I want to do what I want to do. At its simplest, that might mean I want to watch this program, so if you don't mind, we're watching this program. But there are so many other examples that I could give you. Walking past on the other side, I think, is one thing. I'll leave this to you. I know you're extremely busy. You can hardly cope with what is on your plate, but don't ask me to do it, because I want to get home, and I want to go out into the garden, and I want to enjoy the sunshine. So can I leave it with you? Don't ask me to do something that will take 15 or 20 minutes out of my well-planned day. That would just annoy me. I'm so aware of selfishness being a besetting, that's the authorized version, or entangling sin. Is that familiar to anyone else, or once again, is it just me making a confession from up here? For you, it might be watching stuff that you shouldn't watch. It might be reading stuff that you shouldn't read. It might be mixing with friends, going to places at night that you shouldn't go to, because it entangles you and in the process pulls you down, literally pulls you down and ties you up. Throw it away, says Hebrews chapter 12. Don't take it off and carefully just fold it. Throw it away as hard and as fast as you can. Cut it up into little pieces and throw it away. Then the second, let us, again, chapter 12 at the beginning, let us run with perseverance the race set before us. I think I've probably tumbled into this picture already. Running. Excuse me doing that all the time. But running, for some folks in this church, is exciting and wonderful. There are people called runners in the hub. There are people who go to the runners hub. don't understand them really. But for the rest of us, running is not appealing at all. Even for those of us who used to run, knees, hips, just forget it. But I think even the enthusiastic runners in the church, with maybe one or two crazy exceptions, not looking in any particular direction, even people in the running hub, running for miles and miles and miles, long, long, long runs don't appeal at all, particularly if you're afraid that you might get an injury. The race of Hebrews 12, verse 1, I think, is not 100 metres or 200 metres or even 5,000 metres. I think it is at least a marathon. It's maybe several marathons, ultra running, and it goes on and on, and it's tough and it's hilly, and sometimes, sadly, it's lonely. How do I know that? Because it says, run with perseverance the race that's set before you, that's marked out for you. What does perseverance mean? I looked up a dictionary. Persistence in doing something despite difficulty or delay in achieving success. Did you get that? Delay in achieving success. I think that's what the Christian race is like sometimes. And you need endurance. As a committed Christian, you're in it for the long haul. Day by day, as Christians, we're called to persevere and endure. Endure what? Well, think about a long, long race. Pressures, doubts, criticism, abuse, maybe even from fellow Christians. Dehydration in a spiritual sense. Think about that and think about what else happens in a long, long race. Your head might be saying, you can't do this, you're never going to finish this. Friends are saying, you're crazy, you've not trained enough. You'll get rained upon, you'll get scorched, you'll be let down by some people who were supposed to be running with you. And there's a voice in your head saying, pack it in. There's too much stress and strain and criticism involved in this. Pack it in. You're never going to make it. You're never going to gain the prize. Maybe you've been in a long race and you've been hurt. Maybe you've fallen. Maybe friends who said, yes, we'll all run together, ran on and left you behind. But says God's word, keep going. You can do it. Persevere to win the prize. And there is a prize. There's a big prize at the end of the race. And the course is set out for you. Notice that? The course marked out for us. So if you stick to that course, you're not going to get lost. You're not going to waste time and energy running the wrong way. Others on the way are going to pick you up and help you and pull you along. There's water along the way, dehydration stations. Think about what that might mean in the Christian race. And don't forget those who are cheering you on from the galleries. When I ran a marathon, and come on, some of you did know that was going to come out. When I ran a marathon, training alone was a thing I think I hated most. Running 10 miles in the rain on your own was miserable. But running on the big day with 10,000 other people and with your friends, it was weird. 10 miles flew past. Okay, miles 21 to 24 were pretty miserable. But the last 2 miles, it was weird because more and more and more people were gathering as crowds and they lifted you. And I ran in the last couple of miles, you know, showing off. I ran like this the whole way, folks. I didn't. Between miles 21 and 24, I was walking half of it. But you get the picture, don't you? It will not be easy, but we run the race not on our own. Hebrews 10, verse 25. We should keep meeting with others, joining with others. And I need to meet with and listen and read and learn and hub with fellow Christians. Otherwise, it ain't going to work. I've got to keep running, even when it's tough, because the prize is waiting. And then finally, there's the last letters. And this is the most important one by many, many miles. It says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, the one who started and finished for us. Why do we need to do that? How long have you gone? Let me have one last sip of water. There are at least four things that I think, these are personal thoughts. Why do we need to fix our eyes on Jesus? Well, he began and he finished the race. He could say on the cross, it is finished. Then secondly, Jesus knows the way home to God so well that he can say, I am the way. I was thinking about that. It's like watching guys who suddenly have changed their mind about Tiger Woods. He is golf, they will say. And you know what they mean by that. But Jesus can say, I am the way. He can say, I and the Father are one. I am God and God's Son. Worth following, huh? Then thirdly, he's up ahead of us all the time. We can focus on him. And fourthly, he's all in all. As we were running through Hebrews there, we keep getting told what he's done is once for all. And because it's once for all, he can cleanse us from our sin. He's all sufficient. As a little aside, if I may, let me say this to you. If you are looking at a group of people or a pastor, a book, a person who's saying, come this way, I suggest you should stop and ask yourself, where does Jesus fit in as far as these people are concerned? Where does he stand in their beliefs and their preaching? Is he God's Son? Is he the only way? Is he God's salvation? Is he number one? Is he the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega, the only truth, the resurrection and the life, the coming again, Jesus? If he's not, then I suggest you walk away. The writer to the Hebrews says this in verse 3 of chapter 12. Consider him, that's Jesus, who endured such opposition from sinful men so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. And it says actually in verse 2 as well, Jesus, who for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Because he knew exactly what he was doing, Jesus ran his race, and he had a race plan, and he fulfilled it precisely. And he put up with all the evil that was thrown at him because of the joy set before him. And he sits now at God's right hand, waiting to be told, now's the moment to go back again, and he's going to come back in glory. And the new heaven and the new unpolluted earth will be our race prize as well. At Easter time, this is another aside, I switched on the TV and I've no idea how or why I tripped across it. I don't know if it was a one-off or a film or a series, I never managed to check. But it was all about the arrest, the beating, the torture, the crown of thorns, the flogging. That horrific walk up the Via Dolorosa out of the city of Jerusalem with a horrible, heavy lump of wood on shoulders which were bleeding and broken, and then the nails that were put in his hands. And let me tell you, at the end of that, watching that, suddenly afresh, I thought, I understand again what Jesus did for me. The Passion is a film which is a tough, tough, tough watch. But if you were able to watch it, and yes, there's violence in it, but I'm not sure there's much more violence than some of the films that you and I will watch. But when you see what Jesus went through in that film, in his last days, I promise you, you'll be changed by it. Let me finish with this. If you forget everything that I've said this morning, please do forget the Mary Berry and the silly recipe. Even if you forget the let us throw off and let us run, I hope you won't because they're very important. Even if you forget all of that, please remember this. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. I want to suggest to you that's the very essence and foundation of our Christian faith. If you fix your eyes on something else or someone else, you're going to fall. If you fix your eyes on me, I promise you I'll disappoint you very quickly because I keep falling myself. Fix your eyes on the finest Christians in town, a man or a woman. They're going to be great. They'll inspire you. They'll encourage you. But eventually, they too will disappoint you in some way or another. Fix your eyes on Jesus. You'll never be disappointed with him. He'll never let you down. He's the perfect team leader, the perfect example. It says, I think it's chapter 13 of Hebrews, he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Constant, constant, constant. And that's why a very flawed man, St. Paul, and I think the words are coming up there. St. Paul could say this at the end of a very mixed career. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And he knew that a crown of righteousness was waiting for him. This is how the Message paraphrases Hebrews 12, 1-3, and I think the words will come up. Peterson translates it like this. Do you see what this means? All these pioneers who blazed the way, all these veterans cheering us on, it means we'd better get on with it. Strip down, start running, and never quit. No extra spiritual fat, no parasitic sins. Keep your eyes on Jesus, who both began and finished this race we're in. Study how he did it, because he never lost sight of where he was headed. That exhilarating finish in and with God. He could put up with anything along the way, cross, shame, whatever. And now he's there in the place of honor, right alongside God. When you find yourselves flagging in your faith, go over that story again, item by item, that long litany of hostility he plowed through, and that will shoot adrenaline into your souls. I think we all need adrenaline in our souls, don't we? Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. As a church, as individual Christians, let us fix our eyes on Jesus. Amen.